Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Bichette. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Thursday, October 7th, 2021. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered in my 47 years of doing therapy. These tools are available absolutely free at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the Start Here link in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of that book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. It's a tool I've been using to great effect for over 17 years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and also turn any negative emotional experience into part of the infallible guidance system that each one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's completely free. Simple PDF file, click it, download it, print it off, and use it as often as you'd like. You can also download a whole host of audio files of shows just like this one where people have been stepped through the worksheet process or given powerful testimonials about how the use of these tools has improved their life. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness and get access to a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. We hope people do that soon and often because it will improve their life and because it frequently leads to comments or questions or testimonials. If you have any of those to share with us, give us a call at 563-999-3581 and press 1. Alternatively, you can send an email to me at tjh@mindshifters-academy.org or to Jeannie at jeannie@whyagain.org, whyagain.org. We're also doing the Course in Miracles workbook lessons this year. Today is the 280th day of the year. Today's lesson reads simply, what limits can I lay upon creation's offspring? When the Creator created something, it's limitless and it is free. I can invent imprisonment for that person, myself or someone else, but only in illusions and not in truth. No thought of the Creator has ever left the Creator's mind, and no thought of the Creator is limited at all. Thought of Creator is but forever pure. Could I possibly lay limits on the Son of Creation, whose Father willed that he be limitless and like himself freedom and in love? No, I can't. And so today, let me give honor to your offspring. For this alone, I find the way to you. This is the way I find to you. Father, I lay no limits on the Son that you love and you created as limitless. The honor that I give to him is yours. and what is yours belongs to me as well. And the Course in Miracles experiment by Pam Grout, lesson 280, is titled, It's Right on Your Tail. She quotes Kabir as saying, Are you looking for me? I am in the next seat. My shoulder is against yours. Pam writes, After surviving a brutal car accident that ruins his hands, brilliant neurosurgeon Dr. Strange, played by Benedict Cumberbatch in the 2016 movie, he goes looking for truth, for answers, and for wisdom. In his search, he is followed by a strange figure in a dark hoodie. It's all we, the audience, can do to keep from yelling, It's right behind you. It's been following you the whole time. And that's exactly what lesson 280 is trying to tell me. What I am seeking has been there the whole time. I don't have to jump through hoops. I don't have to knock myself out. I just have to stop. Limitless freedom, peace, and joy is literally tailing me. Its shoulder is against mine. It is sitting in the next seat. So today I stop. I use this moment, this very moment, to experience the divine. So that's our shorter than usual Course in Miracles workbook lesson and the Pam Grout commentary. And we've got about 52 minutes to entertain your comments, your questions, your answers, your testimonials. Our call-in number is 563-999-3581. And if you call that number and press 1, it'll put a little question mark by your phone number, and I'll announce you by your area code, and we can have a conversation. What's on your mind? What would be of use for you to spend this day? I was doing some listening and reading with the awareness book by Anthony DeMello this morning, and in the beginning of that book, he starts talking about how we are brainwashed, and we don't even realize it, how we are conditioned to our beliefs. And he has some rather humorous ways to point this out. He tells a story of this one woman walking down the street, and she bumps into an old friend, and she says, Henry, how you've changed. You were so tall, and you've grown so short. You were so well built, and you've grown so thin. You were so fair, and you've become so dark. What happened to you? And Henry says, I'm not Henry, I'm John. And the woman says, oh, you changed your name too. And the point is, when you've got somebody that's stuck in their belief and their conditioning, you might as well stop talking to them, because they aren't going to change. They aren't open for input. They aren't willing to learn something new. They know what they know. And whether we understand it or not, almost every one of us begins our spiritual path in that very same way. We are convinced that we know what's right, what's wrong, who should do this, who should do that. I had experience with someone in my office since the last internet show, and she was quite agitated because she'd really put herself out. She'd really gone the extra mile to help some family members, and she traveled several states over to get there to help them. And when she got there, it was just, the house was a mess. And, you know, one of the parents from a household was in the hospital, and the other one was completely overwhelmed and sick and probably should have been in the hospital. And there's, you know, a child that's special needs, very special needs child, and the house wasn't clean, and she just went on and on and on about how much upset she was generating in her mind because other family members weren't helping and because this family lived in the level of lack of cleanliness that she perceived. And it brought me to the point of recommending for her Pierre Pratervan's work, The Gentle Art of Blessing. Because here she is, coming from the most loving, positive space she knows how to come from, and yet she's generating a tremendous amount of negativity and upset in her mind. Here she is, you know, a week or 2 weeks from returning from doing this good deed and spending a week with this family, and she's still generating a tremendous amount of negative thoughts and upset, and she thinks it's about them, and she thinks it's about the way they live, and her mind is telling her in no uncertain terms that she knows how they should change, how they should change their life, what they should do differently, how they should clean, how they should spend their time, their money, etc., do their own health care, etc. And it was interesting that because she was so willing to look at this, to slow down and to understand that there are probably aspects of her life that someone else looking at it from the outside might say, well, this is wrong, you shouldn't do that, you shouldn't eat that, you shouldn't do that activity, you shouldn't spend your money on that. And she wouldn't want them telling her how to live her life. That's one category of observation we can make. The other category of observation we can make is, how does she feel when she sits in the judgment? How intense is the negative emotional state she generates when she knows they're doing it wrong and she knows how they should do it right and she thinks she's upset because of how they're living their life, when in actuality, she's upset because she's generating the upset. She's upset because she's choosing an interpretation of judgment and blame. And she's looking through the filter of shoulds. And she's looking through a filter of separation rather than true perception. So we're literally brainwashed, we're literally conditioned to believe that we know not only, you know, what's best for us, but how other people should live. And we are trained into the judgment, the right, the wrong, the good, the bad. And our mind, this pattern of thought that we're trained into, will just kick in, just like any autopilot on any good fighter jet or commercial airliner. And once that happens, unless we are able to step back and observe, unless we're willing to take it off autopilot and use our direct observation in the moment to assess where we are and where we're headed, unless we're willing to do that, we stay stuck in that autopilot response, which for most of us is highly negative and detrimental at levels that most of us never slow down to take a look at and understand. This work is geared specifically for that. The primary step one tool in this work is learn to monitor my own internal state of emotional status. upset, relaxation, gratitude, tension, appreciation, joy, contentment. Learn to assess that day in and day out. Learn to live more in the moment where I'm aware of that, where I'm aware of my breath, where I'm aware of the physical energy system we call a body, when I'm aware of tension within my muscular system, because that's where the true early warnings are for my alarm system. So step one in this work is learning to truly engage in that present moment awareness and observation. Step two is anytime I notice that I'm having a tension or a negative emotion, that I take a breath and turn the focus inside myself, that I deny the conditioning of my family and culture, which says I'm only upset because of someone or something outside of me. Turn the focus inside myself, breathe and soften, and start to observe and ask, how am I creating this tension, this resistance, this negative emotion? And if I'm willing to do that, the third step is I pick up a tool. I keep my breath moving and I reach for a tool. I observe directly over and over again that it's a flaw in my thought process which is creating my negative emotion, and therefore applying my thought process to the situation is not going to bring me relief or resolution. So I use a tool that steps me through a process that helps me observe directly what I'm doing with my thoughts that's counterproductive and what my thoughts are telling me needs to happen. And then I cancel all of that and just ask to be shown something else, something more productive, something more something that has the potential to actually shift my situation in a good way. Something that can give me an outside-the-box perspective. Because the only perspective my thought process is going to give me is the same one that created the pain, the fear, the sadness, or the contraction and resistance which brought me to a halt in the first place. It is exceedingly easier to demonstrate this with an example. So if you've got an example of a stressor in your life or a negative emotional state or tension or resistance to a current life situation or a recent one, give us a call and share with us. What is it that you use to generate the upset in your life? 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1, we'll have a conversation. What's on your mind? What is it that you've been working with, or how have you been applying the tools in your life recently? I had the pleasure of interviewing Richard Moss yesterday, and I'm not having any luck currently getting that audio uploaded to Blog Talk Radio, so I may or may not be able to play the interview tomorrow of the Richard Moss interview, the audio of the interview. Tomorrow I will not be here in person because I will be doing the Integrative Mental Health Summit, which runs Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And it's hosted by Journey's Dream, the not-for-profit that's working to try and help rewrite the narrative on mental health in this culture to a new one in which mental health, optimal health and well-being is possible and expected. and to a position in which optimal health and well-being is the outcome for mental health challenges, and that mental health challenges can become transformational as opposed to tragic, the way they are for most people today. And they're tragic for a variety of reasons, including how the conventional approach to interacting with mental health challenges has evolved in our culture. That conventional approach these days is, here's a list of symptoms, and you run into or you go to a professional, and he or she looks at a list of symptoms and then looks at a drug chart and says, well, when you have these symptoms, here's the pill you should take. And many, 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 many people have discovered that is not a very productive way to deal with the complexities of the human mind, heart, and spirit, and that is not the best way to assist somebody through a mental health challenge. So if you want some options, some ideas, some new perspectives on how to deal with mental health challenges, tune in to the Integrative Mental Health Summit, which begins tomorrow and runs Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, October 8th, 9th, and 10th, 2021. You can find the information at that at integrativementalhealthsummit.org. And today's a Thursday, so that means today we've got a support group. It's available online, absolutely free. Anybody who's got an internet connection can join us on Zoom, or you can actually call in through your phone. All of the information about how to connect with us for the MindShifter support group tonight, it runs from 6:30 to 9 p.m. Central. All that information is available at MindShiftersAcademy.org website. And we'd love to have you join us and or pass the information along to somebody you think might benefit. We had a rather intense session on Tuesday, and that's always a possibility, even when there are just one, two, three, four people on the call. It can get quite intense and beneficial as people are processing and applying the tools and or doing this basic process of observing, opening themselves to questioning. What have I been taught in my life? What has the conventional wisdom given me that's helped me get stuck in a pattern of negativity and frustration and judgment, whether it's of self or others? And how might I change that conditioning? How might I learn to question that conditioning and step into a whole new life, basically because of stepping into observation? Live your life the way you would drive your car, eyes wide open, scanning the environment, observing what's there. You wouldn't think of coming to an intersection, regardless of the speed limit on the road, and thinking to yourself, well, the light is green and I have the right of way, so I'm just going to keep driving, even though there's a whole bunch of pedestrians in the crosswalk. Unless you're absolutely having a psychotic episode, you wouldn't even think of doing that. You don't have to ask yourself, what should I do in this situation? When you're observing, your eyes are open, the truth of life act on you, and your reaction, your response, your activity in response to the actuality of life will be clear, it will be focused, it will be effective and efficient. And just as that's true, when you're distracted, when you're not paying attention, when you're on autopilot, which basically is playing out the patterns you've downloaded from the first 6 or 8 years of your life, That's when you keep repeating patterns that are unproductive and wondering, why is this happening to me again? It's not a coincidence that that is the title of Dr. Rice's book. Why is this happening to me again? It's happening to me again because I'm trying to live my life based on what I know rather than what I can observe in the moment. It's happening to me again because I'm not willing to question everything I think I know and step into direct relationship with life each new present moment. One of the things that Anthony DeMello talks about near the beginning of his book is that no matter how much lip service human beings give to wanting something new, they really don't want what's new. And he points out quite clearly, it's not that you have a fear of the unknown. You can't have fear of the unknown. The way he puts it is, you have fear of losing the known. You have a fear of having to give up what you've gotten comfortable embracing, even if it is difficult or painful or abusive. If it's familiar, there's a part of your mind that says, well, I survived this the last 37 times I did it, the last 37 years of my life. So even though I don't like it, I can survive it. And that's a primary driving force in the way the automatic decision system operates. Just that very primitive, you know, if I can survive it, I'm going to stick with it. If I know it, even though it's painful or abusive, but I have survived it for 37 years, I might as well stay with it because there are, at least I know I'll be safe. And I'm not sure if I would be safe with something that I don't know. So oddly enough, we have a fear of losing what we know, even when the thing we know is painful or abusive. Guy Finley says, a lot of people go out in search of what's new. And the weirdest thing is, they go out with a picture in their mind of what they want. Now, to be clear, there's nothing wrong with having a picture in your mind about what you want and going for it. It's also important to recognize whatever you find when you have a picture in your mind and you go out looking for it, it is not new. It is what you have been programmed to desire and go searching for. This is why so often people get into these things about the law of attraction and they think, oh, this is great. I'm going to manifest this and manifest that. And they have no idea that they're enslaved by their conditioning because it's the world that tells them, well, a car is a really good way to get around and a Mercedes is a really premium way premium kind of car to have. And so they decide, okay, I'm going to go and manifest a Mercedes. But the problem is, they have been conditioned into the entire mindset that they need the car, that it's the only way to get around, and that this is the kind of car they should want. So when I'm in that mindset and I have not awakened from the conditioning that has been poured into me from my family and my culture, then I can only desire to manifest those things that I've been conditioned, trained, brainwashed to want. And there are many people out there that think they are just living the good life and wild and free and doing it all on their own, and they've been conditioned by their culture and their family into what is good and what is not good, what is desirable and what is not desirable, how they should spend their energies and their monies and their efforts at accumulation and what they should accumulate and how often and how much. And the true spiritual work, that's why I talk about one of my favorite lines from Guy Finley, that there's nothing more practical than true spirituality. And the true spiritual work will have you wake up first. Come aware, come awake, before you decide who to follow and what to manifest and what skills to learn. Wake up. Understand how conditioned we are. See the false as the false, as Krishnamurti would call us to. See the false parading around as the truth. See all of the ways my mind might try to convince me that it's okay that I be abusive in this situation and that situation in order to change things for the better and then create this better society and then accumulate enough so that I can, you know, I'll be generous with the poor after I make my first $7 million. And in the meantime, what I'm doing to accumulate that $7 million is not good for me, it's not good for my fellow man, it's not good for the environment. But once I get $7 billion, it's changing, $7 trillion, then I'll slow down. Then I'll make sure that what I do is environmentally safe. And the point of this work is that never happens. I can't live in the lie and eventually live along into truth. I can't hate my way into peace. I can't judge my way into loving. I can't resist my way into openness. So, the work we're engaged in is the work of awareness, the work of pursuing awareness through direct observation and observing and questioning everything, especially anything we've been taught. Taught by our family, taught by our culture, taught by our spiritual teacher. If you're not up for questioning everything that's being told to you, you're a prisoner. And some people use this to justify questioning even, you know, directly observable things. Some people use that to justify ignoring actuality. All we're talking about is whatever I can do to get more direct contact with actuality. And the good news is within my system, I've been given this guidance system and this alarm system, which will quickly and pretty much infallibly alert me when I'm not perceiving accurately. And it does that by letting me feel tension or resistance or any of the negative emotions or their stepchildren or any intensely negative thought. When that happens, that's actually my alarm system trying to wake me up to the fact that I am not perceiving accurately. I'm now off in some fantasy of distortion. I am now creating and or responding to an illusion. And if I hope to observe more directly, if I hope to make my situation better, I'm going to need to pause and recalibrate. I'm going to need to breathe and soften and cancel everything that's loaded in my mind consciously and ask for a different perspective, a new insight, a different position from which to look at this, a different interpretation for the very same data points. If I'm not willing to do that, if I'm not willing to engage a tool to assist me in doing that, I will continue to construct the prison that holds me and think it's being done to me. The good news is you are an infinitely powerful creator. The bad news is you don't know that and you keep creating the things that you say you don't want and blaming it on people and things around you. So with blame, we hide our power. The power we're hiding is the power to create our experience of life in each new present moment. And we do that by what we choose to focus on. And with luck, I'll be able to figure out what the technological difficulty is, and you'll be able to hear Dr. Richard Moss talk about that very same process tomorrow on this, in this show, in the time slot that I would normally be live. Hopefully, I will be able to iron out the technical snafu that currently is not allowing me to upload that audio. But he makes exactly the same point. We create our suffering with our thoughts. We generate thoughts about the other person and things around us, about ourselves, about our past, and about our future. And then when we run those thoughts and treat them as true, we suffer. Is this Susan?
It is. Hi, Dr. Tim.
Hello.
Hello. I just got on the show. Sorry, I missed what I heard in the last 3 or 4 minutes. It was fantastic. I've got my grandson here now. He's downstairs. There's no way I can introduce him to the radio show directly at this point. He's not able to have any kind of structure introduced. But he was given, and this is my question coming up, he was given a diagnosis of mild autism. Now, nobody ever picked up on that. He's very high functioning. But it suddenly occurs to me that we need a different way to approach him. And he was taking, I helped clean out his apartment yesterday, did most of it, and then he helped me after he was released from the hospital. And I was glad to have, I'm speaking softly because I think he's downstairs. And I found tons of evidence of LSD mushrooms, nicotine, vaping something, pot. And, yeah, that's about it. And I threw everything away that I could find. Some of his belongings I didn't get to go through before he came, and there may be stuff in there. My question is, number one, do you know how the autistic person's brain responds to the drugs that I mentioned? And number two, he needs a therapist. But I have no idea whether there is a whole different approach for people with autistic thinking processes, whether there's a kind of therapy for them or what. Those are the questions.
Well, one of the things that some people do is they look for people that specialize in treating people who are on that spectrum.
Okay, and I haven't even looked that up.
No,
that makes sense.
And if for no other reason, then, there's a comfort in realizing that people who have the same challenges or traits can be highly functional.
Right.
So, you know, if you have somebody who's been diagnosed as Asperger's, one of the things that is a hallmark of that is the obsessive-compulsive thought process. And there is a rigidity to the obsessive-compulsive thought process. There is a stubbornness. There is a perseverance. And so it often is beneficial to have somebody not just who's trained to deal with that, but who's had some of that experience themselves, simply because there's kind of a comfort and a bond. You know, there's the book, Look Me in the Eye. And this is a book that was written by somebody who, you know, very, very bright intellectually. But he was raised without anybody knowing or identifying and treating him for his autism.
Yeah.
Or Asperger's, whatever you want to call it, depending upon how you want to define that. And because he was so bright, because he was literally at the genius level for electrical engineering, he ended up making lots of money and having people keep him around, even though he had the social skills of a dead rat, right? He was not socially adept at all, but he was so bright that people kept him around because of his usefulness.
Right.
And then later in life, he literally genius formulations in electrical engineering. And later in life, somebody mentioned to him, hey, you know, you kind of sound like this book I read or this movie I saw or whatever. And so he started looking into it himself, and he discovered that he was on the spectrum. And then he said, well, I wonder if I can learn to get better at these social cues. And so he turned his intellectual functioning toward learning how to communicate better and cope with the demand for eye contact, et cetera. And he really, really improved. He didn't get to what you would call normal, but he really improved. And oddly enough, once he did that, he went back to look at some of his electrical engineering genius, you know, explanations and wiring, and he couldn't understand his own work.
Oh, man,
there was a part
scary.
Of his brain. Well, there was a part of his brain that was so focused on learning a different aspect of life and relating to people and communicating that he couldn't easily switch back to that, whatever it was that gave him such facility for electrical engineering. Now, the point of the story, I know that no matter what I say to you, it might generate fear because that's your favorite pain that you like to go to. But the point of the story was not to generate pain or fear in you, right? The point of the story is to understand the flexibility and that these things can be learned.
Mm-hmm.
And also that a lot of people go a long time, a long way into their life without having the understanding of what their needs are and their patterns of functioning are. So, you know, if you read a book like that, or if you read a book like Born on a Blue Day, or if you read some books by some of the people that are autistic and they write from their genius perspective after they've gotten to be an adult, you know, whether it's Temple Grandin or whoever, that can
mm-hmm.
give you some understanding of some of the ways people handle things differently. So some of those things are many people who are on the spectrum are very concrete in their thinking. They're very literal, and they don't get sarcasm, and they don't get a lot of the humor that people use. And one of the wonderful examples was there's this a book written by a gentleman who had Asperger's syndrome, and he was smart enough to get along in life, and he actually got married. And the title of the book will come to me. It's a bit of an unusual title. But he was doing an interview once, and the interviewer asked him, so what have you learned about, you know, relationships, and I mean, how have you made this work? And he said, well, I had to we had a problem because if my wife would come home and she would say, I had a horrible time on my drive to and from work, and the traffic was so bad, and these people were driving like idiots, and I was just so stressed out. And he said, and I would just get out my laptop, and I would plot her five different ways to get to work to avoid those roads. And she would get so upset with me, And I wouldn't understand it. I'm just trying to help. And then she said to him, so, you know, I'm not telling you this so that you solve all my problems. I just need you to listen. I don't want you to fix it. I just want you to, and he goes, oh, that's a unique concept. And the interviewer said, well, so did that work for you? Did that help you? And he said, well, it works sometimes and it doesn't work at others. And the interviewer said, well, what do you mean? And he said, well, not too long after that, I came home and my wife started to talk to me about how upset she was, you know, that I leave my stuff here and I leave it there and I don't do my dishes in the kitchen in a timely fashion and I don't put my clothes in the hamper. And so I just said to her, well, you know, that's really sounds like a difficult situation, honey. And I got up and walked out. And it didn't go so well.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh,
because he was so literal that he took that, here's what you should do. When I give you a problem, I don't want you to solve it. I just want you to listen to me. So he applied that across the board in places where there wasn't any nuance and there wasn't any recognition that in certain situations, his wife was literally asking him to change his behavior.
Right.
And that's just one example. You know, there are the tendency to see things in black and white. There's the tendency to be very literal. There's the tendency towards obsessive compulsive thought patterns or traits that can become a disorder or a problem, or they can just be part of what those people use to stay very detail oriented and be very successful. I mean, as you might imagine, in the story of the gentleman from the book Look Me in the Eye, he needed his obsessive compulsive focus on detail to be able to do what he did with his electrical engineering and wiring diagrams and things like that. And yet,
wow.
What is my greatest strength will at times be my greatest weakness. What are my greatest mm-hmm. assets will at times be my greatest liabilities. This is part of what we observe in our lives. And when I don't have the flexibility, which is another trait, that rigidity that goes along with the autism spectrum, then it tends to amplify my problems when I have problems, as well as it amplifies my strengths and my successes when I have those.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just you need somebody, if you're going to have a therapist for someone like that, you need somebody who at least is well-read in that and or has dealt with those kinds of people before, if not somebody who's actually on the spectrum themselves and has worked to overcome it.
That's
to be
good.
Functioning
I'm going
as a
to go
therapist.
Online and explore. What, Dr. Tim? I missed
I just finished
time.
It by saying who has gone on to become a therapist.
Oh, I see. Right. Well, one of Jacob's fears is that if he changes, he won't be able to write music anymore. And that was the scary part of what you said about this engineer, is he couldn't understand his own genius after he improved. I certainly am not going to tell Jacob, partly because I just don't know what to make of his creativity, which is seemed to have taken a terrible nosedive after he started taking this LSD. He thought he was writing brilliant stuff, but it's really just almost unintelligible. And he's had to drop
out
of school.
That happens a lot. That happens a lot with people who do the mind-altering drugs. It is, and you were asking me about, you know, what's the impact of that on somebody who's on the spectrum, and there is no good answer for that because it's individual to every person. It's not like there's, you know, I know people who have taken many, 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 many trips with different drugs and hallucinogenic mushrooms and they swear by it.
Yeah.
I also know people, and unfortunately I've had a whole series of them throughout my career. Fortunately, not very often, but every once in a while, I have somebody referred to me who just is not functioning well in the world, and they track it back to the first time or the one or two times that they did a hallucinogen. And
that's scary, yeah, that's true.
And it's not something that can be predicted. Nobody knows who's going to have a bad trip or a good trip. Nobody knows who's going to have lasting effects. Just like if people get COVID and they have the long-haul COVID symptoms, nobody knows who's going to get that and who's just going to recover in a few weeks and be back to fairly normal.
Right.
But the idea is it's fairly clear based on what you're presenting that it's not an ally for him to use those hallucinogens because, as you just finished saying, he was writing music, and then when he started doing this stuff, his work is basically unintelligible.
Mm. Well, I hope the effects can wear off. He's 21. He's young. He has extreme anxiety, too, and social skills are terrible. So Kim and I are trying to offer him some structure to his day. He stayed up most of the night last night and told me he couldn't sleep at all, and he had promised to go for a walk. So we went for a walk, but he was in a terrible mood. And anyway, this is going to be a challenge, Dr. Tim.
Yes, it always is. And bless your heart for taking it on. How is your housemaid?
She left yesterday or the day before, just when we learned that Jacob was being released from the hospital, which is a miracle and a godsend because we thought she'd be with us for at least a month and maybe as much as a year. But they found her a place and they packed her up and we all packed her up and she left and I didn't have a chance to clean the place down there before Jake came, but we're sort of pitching in and getting it in shape. One of the things about Jake that is astounding to me, but probably exactly like autistic people or some, is that he lives in complete physical chaos. Bags and boxes of clothes all crumpled up, some washed, some not. His room was, his roommate's mother cleaned the apartment, bless her, and put all Jacob's stuff in his room. And when I went in the room, which is a good size room, the stuff was piled as high as my chest. And so they had left so I could drag everything out, put things in categories, throw away a ton of stuff, some of it good, just because we didn't have room in the two cars we were going to be driving to get back here. But Jacob said to me at one point, it makes me very anxious to live in this kind of a mess. And I said, well, let me help you get organized and then we'll keep it up. And but now that he's here, his stuff is all over the place. And granted, he just got here, so I'm not going to say anything much. But in the next few days, I'm just hoping he'll allow me to kind of coax him into making his environment bearable. But for him, it might not affect him. But I look at it and I think a person who's living here is not very well. But that may be just my conclusion and have nothing to do with reality.
Well, you know, I, as with always in this work, I just encourage people to monitor what they're doing with their own mind energy to create tension or sadness or fear or worry, and use whatever tool, whether it's Pierre Pradervan's Gentle Art of Blessing or the Michael Rice worksheets or EFT tapping, to dismantle the tension and the negative emotions as soon as you can, hopefully before acting, before speaking and acting, so that you have a chance to be in closer proximity to what's actually going on and seeing the truth of the other person and their nature and the truth of you and your nature, and let that truth be the thing that drives your action rather than your conclusion that, oh boy, that's scary, or oh boy, that's bad, or...
Right. That's good advice, Dr. Tim.
Just keep remembering, if you're going to be there for somebody, that it's most important. It's just like the oxygen mask in a plane. Put it on first. Put yours on first.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Before you go to help him live a healthier life, make sure you're in that space of compassion and love and appreciation and, you know, routinely seeing others in their highest and best and then choosing to cooperate only with that.
Good.
Because when you're focusing on what the person isn't doing that you want them to do or what you think they should do, you are not as well or accurately focused on their strengths.
Right.
And their autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
And their ability to choose and, you know, change their life, live their own life, etc.
Yeah, I know. I have this goal to help him feel better and to be healed. And the last time he lived with us, he lived in the basement, slept a good part of the day, stayed up all night, tried to do music. He was on his drugs then too, lived in chaos, came upstairs when he felt like it, ate a lot of junk food. And I just witnessed this and felt as if there was nothing I could do about it. And now he's back here. And I don't know how to balance the goal of wanting to help or heal or fix or whatever with the apparently destructive path he's on. Now, maybe there's the error right there, is I'm thinking it's destructive.
Well, the key in this work is, what are you feeling when you reach that conclusion? When you reach the conclusion that he's on a destructive path and you need to fix him, do you have a tension in your body or a negative emotion come up? And if so, there's your work. Before stepping into trying to fix him, right, then you've got what Yeshua would have called the blind leading the blind. Then you've got somebody who's in an absolute panic about what her grandson is doing in his life. And she, from that absolute panic, thinks he should have a better, healthier life where he's not living in chaos and he's not living in high anxiety. And so from her place of panic, she's going to judge that he shouldn't be in panic.
Right. All true.
So, bless your heart, bless his heart. We'll be sending loving thoughts and blessings to the entire family. I will thank you for the call and turn off your microphone so you can listen into the second hour. And remind us all that we come from love. We're made of this stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. And I'll welcome Jeannie Rice.
Thank you, Dr. Tim. Appreciate it. You have a good rest of the afternoon.
Thanks. I'll work on that. I'm in the process of trying to upload a file for tomorrow, since I will be doing this Integrative Mental Health Summit, integrativementalhealthsummit.org, for the information on that. And I have not been having any luck so far today. I've uploaded the file twice, and it shows it's only 5 minutes long. So I will be working on that or something else for tomorrow's show.
Are you going to play for all 3 days, for Thursday and Friday?
Well, hello? I don't need to play one for Thursday because we just finished Thursday's show.
Oh, this is Thursday.
Yep.
I haven't marked yesterday off the calendar. I don't know what day we are. Okay, thanks.
We are
Just let me know.
On today, and it's only one day. It's Friday. All right.
Okay.
Blessings.
Gotcha. Okay, bye-bye. All right, so welcome, everybody, to the second hour of Mind Shifters Radio. Today is Thursday, October 7th, 2021. I'm just running a day behind. And our call-in number is 563-999-3581. And press 1, and that puts you into queue to talk to us. And we'd love to hear your comments and questions because that makes this your show. So give Michael just a moment to get dialed in. And, you know, it's funny because I mark the days off of the calendar in the kitchen so that Dad knows what day it is. And I didn't mark yesterday off. And so it's not just Dad, it's me that doesn't know what day it is. So anyway, we get in habits, don't we? And get in the habit of looking up there and seeing what day is not marked off and saying, okay, that's today. And making up a reality, whether it's true or not. And this one was not actuality. It was just in my mind. So anyway, we welcome you to the show. And it does help when you press 1, when you have questions or comments, and let us know what topic you want to talk about. If you have something going on and you need support, that's what we're here for. And so I invite you to go to the website, whyagain.org, and click on either the Start Here button in the upper left corner, or you can scroll down and there's a bullseye in the middle of the page. There's a lot of information on our website, and we've just switched over to a new format, a new, it's on WordPress now instead of Joomla, and so everything looks different. Some things are in the same place, some things are a little different, but all the information is still out there. So if there's something you can't find, even that, you can press 1 and say, hey, I'm looking for the commitment, or I'm looking for the codependence worksheet or whatever, and I can direct you where you can find it. And if it's not easily found and you would like for it to be somewhere else, just let me know that. Drop me a line at Jeannie, J-E-A-N-I-E, at whyagain.org. And let me know, and I'll see what I can do to get things shifted around on the website. We want it to be usable, and we want it to serve you. So just let us know. Welcome, Michael.
We want it to be perfect, right, sweetie?
Absolutely. And it gives me a challenge when it's not.
OCB.
I know. I was just telling them while I was waiting for you to dial in. Dr. Tim is in the Mental Health Summit, and so he's trying to get a MP3 to upload to play tomorrow. And
oh, cool.
I said, you know, I mark days off on the calendar so Dad knows what day it is. And I didn't mark yesterday off, and so I thought it was Wednesday. And I asked Dr. Tim, I said, oh, okay, so do you need one to play for Thursday and Friday? And he goes, well, we just completed Thursday. I said, okay, that's how a reality is in my mind, and it has nothing to do with actuality. But anyway, so we welcome everybody to the show. Welcome, Michael.
Well, and we need to recognize that when we call this Thursday, that's really just another construct of the mind. It's a reality. It's not an actuality. You know, the fact that the Earth revolves around the sun and we divide it up into parts and called it certain months and called it certain days and hours and minutes, it's all a fantasy. It's a good fantasy.
Yeah, but it
works.
Does help.
Oh,
if
yeah,
we didn't
yeah,
it have
works.
It. Yeah.
Yes. There are useful fantasies and there are destructive fantasies, and it's just a good thing to be aware of anytime we're engaged in a fantasy, that's what it is. And if it's useful, great, you know, engage in it. But if we don't distinguish those things, then we can slide the slippery slope of believing that fantasy is actuality, something we make up, and then we can get into difficulty when we move into certain realms. So welcome, everyone. Delighted and honored that you're here. Been a busy morning here this morning, trimming tomato trees. Our tomato tree is over 10 feet tall this year and getting ready to build a hoop house that we're hoping to be able to bend them down into that they'll survive a longer season than when cold weather hits here, which will probably happen in the next 3 or 4 weeks. So that's always an interesting we're learning lots about doing gardens. We heard about using what they call beneficial nematodes. I thought, well, we'll get these little toads. And it's like, no, Michael, these are microorganisms that take care of pests naturally. So we have a bag of nematodes in our garden. So our next study is to learn how to apply them and get a head start on next spring and summer's gardens and taking care of the pests that otherwise might inhabit. And we're honored and delighted that you're here to engage in this conversation about conscious, active, present love. And we had mentioned Mahatma Gandhi. We came across a couple of his quotes in this particular chapter. So for the first time in probably, I don't know, how many years since we watched that, sweetie? 7, 8 years ago we watched it at Heartland?
Probably.
And it's a movie that we've shown several times over the years. In fact, I really wasn't conscious that I just about have the movie memorized and just about every key line I can come up with. But watching that film, what became clear to me, I was talking to a friend today, and he was talking about exposing evil and, you know, Satan and no. It's like all these fantasies that people have made up that block us from recognizing the truth that needs to be exposed. And one of the lines that Gandhi came up with, and sometimes people, especially will look at my Facebook posts, and some of them aren't very nice, and they're quite purposely not very nice. Very, very, very purposely done to educate and expose. And they're done from love. They're done from a connected space. Just here's how it's going. Here's how it's working. Here's what's happening. But here was the I had forgotten this particular line that came out of Gandhi's mouth, but he's like, that's the reason I spend the time I spend. People said, well, why do you waste your time? No, there's no waste there. But here's what Gandhi said. We must make the injustice visible. And then I add to that, or it hides under the cloak of sophistry. You know, we can take, I'm actually working an article on this issue of sophistry, and we can take an example of sophistry. And this is just like a simple factual thing you can look at and go, oh, we're being lied to, and they're trying to make the lies look true. This is just a simple physical example, and this example goes out into every arena. And, you know, one of the frauds of the world is that they're always talking about how there's this fight between good and evil. And the lie that it's a fight between good and evil is just another story to keep people from understanding, to keep the truth of what's going on from being exposed. So here's my example of sophistry. You're a wheat farmer. You grow wheat. You mill your own wheat, and then there comes a point where there's too much wheat for you to mill, and there's a mill in town. So you take your wheat to the mill, and the granary, you know, they grind it for you, and they give you back a certain amount, or they pay you for it. And then what they learned was, and here's the exposure that we need to understand, and it pervades everything right up into politics, religion, relationships, men and women, the whole game. This is the exposure that's needed. So what the millers learned, I'm not talking about the miller family, I'm talking about those who mill grain, is they could mill the grain and they could steal all of the nutrients from the grain. They'd take all the vitamin E and all of the minerals and all of the nutrients, take them out and package them and sell them to pig farmers who know that their pigs need to be well fed in order to reproduce and in order to live long, healthy lives. The nutrients are stolen from the grain, and then the leftover, and I use this word very cautiously and very purposely, the leftover poison is called white flour, or if you look on most packages, it'll say enriched flour. You know what enriched means? This is another piece of sulfur. You know what enriched means? We stole all the nutrients out of this, but we put back three or four chemical nutrients made from oil, and we call it enriched. It's kind of like, you know, you steal somebody's whole wardrobe, their clothes and everything, and you throw them back a pair of socks. And we say, now we've enriched you. Enriched white flour, or just enriched flour. If the word white isn't there, it doesn't matter. If it says enriched flour, if it doesn't say whole, then it is sophistry. It's a poison. Now, you know, I could go into just about every restaurant in this city and say I'd like an ABC sandwich, whatever it is. And you know what I'm going to get? I'm going to get whatever I want on that sandwich between two slices of poison. But the sophists, and where did that come from? Where did they learn that? Back in Greece, eons ago, there was a group of people that were called sophists. And one of the sophistries they've played is they've made us believe that sophistry means wisdom. Sophia is wisdom. Okay, let's go for the truth now. Here are these Greek philosophers who travel around Greece teaching the wealthy how to lie. Why would the wealthy want to lie to be able to steal? It's called greed. This is the core of the exposure. This, it's not good and evil. It's greed and generosity. Or greed and honesty. So these philosophers taught the wealthy, or pardon me, the children of the wealthy, for big bucks, how to lie and make their lives appear true. So what does the miller do? He takes this leftover white poison. Literally, if it were all you ate, it would kill you. And then they hired Madison Avenue to create an ad campaign. And they created a fancy, bright plastic package, toxic in itself. And on the side of it, it says, builds bodies in whatever number of ways the current lies are. People look and they go, oh, I saw this on television. They told me it builds bodies in 12 ways, so this must be good. Now, why would a miller do that? It's called greed. Why would a person who says, oh, we have a product called whole wheat, it is a whole nutritious substance, and we are going to provide that whole substance to people who buy our bread. Why would they do that? Because of honesty and generosity rather than greed. Stealing the nutrients to sell them once and selling the leftover food. Now, if you look at that, you look at what Republicans are selling, you look what Democrats are selling, you look at what independents are selling, you look at what virtually everybody's selling, and to one degree or another, and some are much more extreme than others, there's sophistry in it. And it goes on and on and on and on. The sophistry in the theology is, you're supposed to love your neighbor. That's like the white bread. It was never said. They understood in the Aramaic language it was a condition that was needed in the mind in order for love to be present, in order for you to be whole, like the whole wheat. And so this is what needs to be exposed. Is my offering. So Gandhi, we finished off with him saying, the greatest help you can give me is to banish fear from your hearts. And you look at the kings who will tell you about how fearful and terrible the world it is. Now guess what the king who's going to tell you about that bad guy out there is going to do? He's going to turn you into the bad guy. He's going to hand you weapons. He's going to tell you to kill so that some other king somewhere else can tell the lie about those bad people. And you believe the ones that are working for that king are bad, and they believe these ones that we're working for this king and that we're bad. And the lie goes on, and the whole thing needs to be exposed. Greed versus truth and generosity is the bottom line of the whole game. And so Here's another piece of sophistry. We've just been talking about how a lack of love compromises intelligence, and that it's important to learn how to cast out the demon fear. And if we don't, we'll find ourselves unwittingly acting in support of that fear. You know, take a look. I'm kind of appalled on a day-to-day basis. You know, across, you know, I get thousands of emails. And you look at most of the marketing in those emails, and it's all terrorism. It's all fear-based. You open it, you listen to the video about this wonderful product, and the first thing you're going to tell you is about how, well, as you get older, as you this, or your child does this, this is going to fall off, this is going to break, and you better have this or else. Terrorism marketing. And I'll just put this thought out. If you get marketing from terrorists, I suggest that you hit a reply to the marketer and tell them you don't want their terrorist marketing, and you delete yourself from their mailing list, unsubscribe. When we start doing that, the terrorism marketing is going to go away. If somebody's got a good product, they're going to tell us what's good about it, rather than have to terrorize us as, well, you'll get the ABC disease or the XYZs or this body part won't work or that part, or because you're getting older. It's like, no, there's none of it's because you're getting older. Age has got nothing to do with it. That's another sophistry. It's what you put in your mouth is what comes out of your mouth. It's key here. Do you live out of a verbal state of generosity and honesty, or do you live out of a verbal state of greed? Do your behaviors, which flow from your words, reflect greed, taking for self? Oh, I want the pleasure for me. To heck with you. I want all the profit for me, to heck with you. Or is there abundance and generosity in your spirit? Because being is abundant and generous. All the rest of it is a learned response that can be forgiven. I was talking to someone this morning. And we're talking about, well, but, you know, it's a dog-eat-dog world. It's like, well, actually, do a little research. You know, there's an interesting video we watched recently on YouTube. And there's a farm. And they knew that one of the ducks was about to have ducklings. But they couldn't find them. They disappeared. Figured, well, I guess some predator got them. They go out of the barn where the cat is. And the cat, who just had kittens, collected up all these ducklings and was nesting with them and nurturing them. Now, the kitten, normally, the cat, if it came across a duckling, would eat it. It's a learned response. But because this, it appears that because this cat had just had kittens, there was this mothering instinct that came out, the need to nurture. And so instead of eating, and there's so many examples of animals that, you know, we say they're born killers, but they have to be trained. Their parents, you watch, you know, nature video after nature video, and they'll tell you about how the lion, and now the lion lioness is going to teach your cubs how to hunt, how to take the animal down, how to kill, how to... It's learned. It's not innate in being. And I suspect that's what led the ancient scriptures to say there'll come a time when the lion will lie down with the lamb. Because all of life, when humans make the choice, awaken to choice and function as love, as we're designed to do, then the viciousness, the violence, and the dog-eat-dog world will literally disappear. It is not natural. It is learned and therefore can be forgiven. And remember that the word forgive doesn't mean it can be let off the hook. It means that we can remove the roots of the greed, of the viciousness, of the violence, of the need to get mine first. The need to get mine and to heck with you getting yours. You know, and that comes right down into relationships. You know, it comes right down into the arena of sexuality. How many times do we hear the complaint, oh, yeah, well, once he or she, you know, then they don't bother with me anymore. We need to wake up to the state of aliveness and generosity in every arena of our lives. And though a part of the mind may go against it when you first start to do it, you find the part of the mind that goes against that is insane. It's a learned response that's come from generational patterns, and sometimes it can play out some very strong, you know, motivation to do whatever that is. And if you chip away at it with forgiveness, it will disappear. So Richard, trapped in sophistry, even though he's heard this man from 2,000 years ago who said fear is a demon to be cast out, or is spoken about as a demon, and you'll notice that several times he says, fear not. But the sophists in those platforms up in front of the church are still using the fear game. Oh, the beginning of wisdom is fear of God. That's the epitome of sophistry. And these preachers know that if they can keep people in fear, or it's just a habit that's been trained in them, if they can keep people in fear, they can control them forever. If they don't function as abundant, generous, whole, functioning love, they can't own them. They can't control them. They can't get their nutrients from them and sell them on living on white flour. So Richard's, in his being entrapped in sophistry, breaks in on my conversation. Says, I've seen fear motivate people to do the right things. My reply to him is, in the short term, I agree. You can get people to do things out of fear. Have you noticed the long-term result is always a disaster? For instance, a parent forces a child with threats and abuse, or even rewards. The child obeys the parent out of fear, but in the end hates them and passes the force and abuse on to others. The reason is the tools used to produce a result will always produce a result like the tools. I'm on page 125, by the way, if you're following this in the book. Children are learning sponges. They are believing creatures. What they live with, they learn. And then they live whatever it is that they have learned. And you know, the parent that teaches violence, that teaches bullying, I remember one time I was in Key West, Florida, and they have a little trolley that goes around. I went in and sat on the trolley, and a guy gets in. The trolley's fairly full, and he gets in, and he sits beside me, and then he's got his wife and, I don't know, two or three or four kids. And everybody can't get in. So he literally starts pushing me, like, you know, go find a seat somewhere else. And became verbally abusive in doing that when I did not comply with his goal. And I just, you know, his kids were quite small, you know, maybe 3, 4, 5 years. They'd been circling the sun. And it's like, Mr., you have no idea what your life is going to be like when those children take this modeling that you're teaching them, this verbal, vicious assault, self-centeredness, greed. You want it all for yourself and turn it on you. You're going to go, gee, I wonder where I went wrong. I wonder why my children are so nasty to me. I wonder why they don't bother with me. Well, wake up. Children are learning sponges. And we've all been subject to that. So Richard says, that makes too much sense. His whole being seemed to confirm his agreement with my words. Yes, and there's a peace when one achieves a practical understanding of tools that work and has the intellectual basis to reinforce that understanding. This work draws on all disciplines in order to build a solid foundation for undoing of unconsciousness and for life that is harmonious and peaceful. With this synthesis of different disciplines, it's a big chunk to bite off, I acknowledge, a big chunk to chew. It takes patience and time to build the brain cells and integrate each of the disciplines upon which this work is built. That foundation is what makes these tools fully available. If you've been brainwashed into the sophisticated world, you're going to have to develop a whole different language, a whole different set of brain cells, a whole different understanding of life. And my offering is, if you're starting on this path and doing these using these tools, my observation is it takes between 5 and 10 years for people to really make a shift around and really comprehend what it is that we're talking about. So be patient. It takes time. Some unconsciousness, as you undo the patterns of the past and move into understanding and knowledge, is to be expected. So you're going to access that unconsciousness, allowing deeper issues to surface in the presence of love, quite literally burns them off, so to speak. If you're willing to look into yourself, your family interactions, and the dynamics of the culture, healing accelerates. An unwillingness to take a deeper look means that old patterns will tend to be passed on and played out by the next generation. Conscious, active, present love is the key to healing whatever needs to be healed. And so in our metaphor of the sophist taking the nutrients out of the bread and selling the white poison as food, it's kind of what we're talking about here. Thinking you've got a human life, if love is not conscious, active, and present in you, it's like being the white flower without the nutrients in it, without the vitamin C and without the vitamin E and without the wheat germ, all that stuff gone. When conscious, active, present love is removed from a human life, is blocked from awareness, then we function kind of like the white flower. We tend to be poisonous to ourselves and to others. And my offering is that is the reason for all disease, death, and suffering. And the objective of this work is to restore us to the wholeness that we are designed for. To restore the nutrient base that is provided by conscious, active, present love. And so we are honored that you're here to be part of this conversation. And Miss Jeannie, do we have anybody in the phone queue with a hand up? Anything happening in the chat room?
No, it is all quiet. So if someone presses one, you're first in line. We have 31 minutes. We have a hand just went up.
Awesome.
And it's area code 904. You're on the air. Hi. I think this is Dusty.
Yes, it is.
Well, welcome, young man. Good to hear your voice. How do you be?
I be well. And listening to your entertaining and elucidating ramble on history was really fun. I really enjoyed that and learned. And I have this question that I've been wanting to ask you about history. And
great.
While I don't even have an answer, nonetheless, I thought I'd throw it out there.
Let's go for it.
Okay. There are some well-known authors through the years that have stated that the greatest literary mystery in the world, I will add in the Western world, are the missing years of Yeshua. And while I realize Aramaic was around a long time before all that happened, I wonder if there's anything that has come out of that perspective that Aramaic that might shed any light on it.
Well, you know, there are many traditions. I mean, there are places in Japan where people swear that's where Yeshua studied in the Japanese culture. There are places in the Buddhist world, you know, what ultimately functions Buddhism that say that that's where he was. There are traditions that say he was in India and he went to India and studied with the ancient masters there. There are all kinds of stories, and I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think anybody does, but you do hear those stories about, I think, a guy named Milovic who did the big thing in Lhasa, and, you know, that guy came here, and we called him Issa, and there's all those kind of things, but who's to know?
Well, there's a tradition also in North America. There's a book out there called He Walked the Americas. And the Mormons, you know, their foundational documents come from scrolls that, or plates, gold plates that were supposedly exposed, and when Yeshua, you know, walked the Americas and things, you know. So there are many traditions. Everybody wants to claim him. I don't know. What I want to do, though, is I want to understand the principles of what he taught. And rather than creating, you know, let's create another church or another set of BS belief systems about it, it's like, let's just develop some tools, hand the tools to people, tell them don't believe anything, try it out, watch what happens. And when people try it out, it works. And the rest, to me, I mean, it would be interesting to know intellectually, but the truth is, for me, it really doesn't matter.
Right. And, yeah, unless you know you're getting the straight on it. It's just
exactly.
Another,
I've read several of those traditions, and, you know, I mean, each one of them purports to be true stories, but who knows how much sophistry there is there.
Thank you. And also, you know, that thing about history and self-history, and I constantly have this thing coming back in my face. I keep seeing where... you know, it takes integrity to learn from self-history or any kind of history. And that saying, those who don't learn from history are bound to repeat it. Well,
right.
I found that the self-absorbed and the greedy don't want to learn from history. Typically, don't want to.
Right. Right.
You know, that are on an upward path somewhere, somehow, that have the integrity that really... very powerful to that self-history and what to do with it.
Okay. Yeah. One of the things I like to do is to break down words. And if you break down that word, you know, what have you got? His story. You know, there's a saying out there that says, you know, the winner is history, and that's very true, you know. I can bet that if Hitler had won World War II, the history of World War II would be much different than the history that's told today. You look right now at what's going on in the political arena, and you see that there are people who want to write the history of what's happened in the last year in America as it actually happened. And then you hear other people who say, oh, no, that didn't happen at all. Their story is a totally, completely, I mean, we watched it with our own eyes. And, you know, people say, that was just like, you know, that thing that happened at the Capitol, that was just like a normal tour through the Capitol. It was nothing happened. And it's like we watched it with our own eyes. And to me, that's such a great example of history and somebody telling their story and wanting it to be the dominant story. And the truth is, around any given event, there are 1,000 histories, because each person's mind generates its own reality. And, of course, if one is in blockage of truth, they'll tend to live in one story that their mind tells them. Someone who's got a different blockage lives in a different story. And someone who honors truth gets to at least get close to a description of, here's the actuality, here's what actually happened. Because the difference between actuality and reality is monumental for most people. If you've ever sat in a courtroom and watched 6 different people testify about an accident, and you wonder if any 2 of them were at the same accident, how did that occur? Because every mind produces its own reality, its own perceptual construct about any given event.
I used to notice that when I started my video production business, I was a certified court videographer. And I would go do depositions, and there'd be lawyers there. There'd be
right.
And anyways, usually at a long, you know, conference table, and I was at one end. And my job, other than to arrange the room, get things ready, get all the lighting and the microphones ready, and to read something to open to it, always video it and do the audio exactly as purely as I could at the moment. And I found,
right.
You know, if I had a personal bias, there are little tricks I could do with the camera if I wanted to make one person look a little less and another person look a little more. This,
yep.
That. I did everything right down the middle. But it doesn't take much to skew things off.
Right.
At least.
Yep.
And I had dominance in some way. It reminded me that I had an acquaintance called Ed Eagle McGaw, and he wrote a book. He was a Sioux Indian. He was a shaman there, but he was also a tiger pilot from Nam, go figure. And he wrote a book, and the one takeaway that I got from the book, the major one, was he used the phrase, the dominant.
Right.
So many think that this is the culture. No, it's not the culture. It's a culture, and there's so many cultures, and there has been so many cultures. It's the dominant.
Right. Well, one of my favorite quotes from, you know, we talked about Mahatma Gandhi earlier, they purportedly asked him what he thought of Western civilization. He said he thought it would be a good idea.
Yeah, right.
You know, and of course we call it civilized, and, you know, like how many different perspectives are there on that? Well, I guess it depends whether you're black or you're white, whether you live in the South or the North, or, you know, there's a whole lot of things that depend on what your perceptual construct is of the culture. Certainly, if you're Native American, this culture looks a whole lot different than for anybody else. And, you know, it's interesting with this work, you know, way back, Dusty, this would have been probably maybe a year or so before I met you originally, way back in Atlanta several decades ago. I went to law school. And I did that for about a year, and then I realized that that wasn't the route I wanted to go, that I wasn't interested in going there. I was studying naturopathic medicine at the same time. But I withdrew from law school, but ended up co-authoring a course called Laws of Living with an attorney. And the course, you know, the root of it, because he was an attorney and because I had some law school training, we use the rules of evidence that are used by a court for determining whether or not information gets in about the final story. So there were, rather than, you know, everybody has their own perception because the human mind is just an evidential device, but over centuries, the legal profession, now not proclaiming that it's always applied honestly, but the legal profession, you know, created a set of rules for whether or not something gets into evidence or whether it's blocked from evidence.
Right.
And that was what we used when translating that first century Aramaic text called the Kabur's Manuscript from Aramaic into English. You know, we worked with 25 of the world's top Aramaicists. Pardon me, I shouldn't say we. Dan McDougall, my partner, worked with 25 of the world's top Aramaicists. And he was like the center figure in the translation work, and all the translation work would come back to him. And he would use the rules of evidence that had been established through the legal profession for determining whether or not something got into the translation. And then, and we still didn't consider that that translation was accurate until, and this was my job in the process, it was taken, I take it into the classroom, teach it, apply it, and see if it works. If it worked, then we considered the translation validated. Otherwise, the translation was still in question, even though 25 of the world's top Aramaicists agreed on a particular meaning of a word. Now, there's one particular story that I remember. There's a there was a fellow in Chicago. His name was Marsh Schumann, and he was would be the equivalent of the Pope of the Church of the East. So he was an Eastern Orthodox bishop or archbishop in Chicago. And whenever there was a conflict on a particular word, you know, trying to get clarity, couldn't get the translators to agree, Marsh Schumann would be who Dan would go to as the tiebreaker. And I remember Dan telling this story about how he would go to Chicago to, you know, he'd have a number of things he'd quiz this gentleman about. And one of the words in particular was the word neighbor. And in Aramaic, the word neighbor means someone who's mentally near to you. So if you think about someone, they're your neighbor. And what that directive that says love your neighbor actually meant was you needed to maintain the condition of rachma so the gateway was open so that you were in a state of love when you thought about neighbor. Otherwise, if your mind wasn't fueled by love, you could make up any kind of garbage you wanted to and justify anything that you might do to your neighbor. And so he went to talk to Marsh Schumann because there was much conflict among the translators about the meaning of this word, neighbor. Is it physical? Is it just the guy down the block? And I'll never forget how Dan mimicked Marsh Schumann. He used to describe Marsh Schumann as being older than God. And he asked him about this, and he mimicked him, and you know, he waves his arm, and he's like, and he's mimicking Marsh Schumann. Oh, I know what's got, and Shapley was one of the top guys, and he kept holding out for neighbor as being this physically near to you person rather than someone you think about, someone mentally near. And he mimics Marsh Schumann waving his arm and kind of waving him off. It's like, I know what's got Shapley mixed up. He's been reading those new dictionaries they wrote in the 6th century. And that was the point where the generals, the military people, in order to justify going to war, changed the definition of the word from anybody that you think about, anybody mentally near to you, to the guy down the block, which means, well, we can go over, you know, to the village on the other side of the river, and we can go steal their property and steal their women and make slaves of their children and kill the ones that, you know, get in the way. And that became justifiable because you didn't have to have love in your mind when you approached those people because they weren't your neighbors. Because it's just, I just have that burned into my brain. Oh, I know it's got Shapley confused. He's been reading those new dictionaries they wrote in the 6th century.
That's all time. That's great. The new dictionaries in the 6th century. Yeah.
Yeah, the new ones.
I love that definition. I mean, that's really how I operate and think. They're what they came up with for neighbor, although I never consciously thought of it as anybody I think about, but it's true. That's really true. And I was going to point, we talked about the child or something to that effect, and when Cynthia and I lived out there, a lot of concepts, a lot of seeming realities would come through, and how do you distinguish what's real and what isn't? And what I did was I would do something I called as if, and I would take the concept or whatever, or modality, some kind of modality, and I'd put it on sort of like an old shirt, like a shirt. And I'd wear it for a little period of time. It could be seconds. It could be days. And if it was really true for me or worked for me, and it kind of became a shirt and part of it, and if it didn't, it would fall off. But without giving it the as if or giving it a trial in many cases, I would not know. But that was the as if technique.
Right. Tool used.
And I had a
cool.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just saying that that sounds right on.
Thank you. And you didn't by any chance go to that law school that was just to downtown, north of downtown Atlanta, not too far off Peach Street, Atlanta School of Law or something like that?
No, actually, that was one of the schools in Atlanta. No, this was one up on the northeast side of town. It was Columbia Southern College of Law. It no longer exists. They brought in a proprietary school law where you had to have so many thousands of square feet of library and that sort of thing, and it disappeared.
Oh, okay. Because about the same time, I guess it was 69 or 70, I came up with a benefactor that offered me a free ride to that law school that I was just talking about.
Interesting.
And, and I mean, the guy was on the board and he taught there and he was a beautiful, beautiful man, a lot of honor. And, but I didn't do it. I mean, I had just gotten out of the army. I was still bouncing off the walls. I couldn't sit there and stop. Okay? I couldn't even do it in school. So I had to pass.
Right. Interesting.
Parallel right there in a way.
Yes.
But that thing about
yes.
dominance, and I don't know. I guess it's something I carry inside, and there are tendrils that go out to different people like you or Patrick or other people that help maintain a certain sense of cultural integrity, but just walking down the road, seeing people won't do it to me. I need a real connection of some kind of somebody with some integrity and some kind of consciousness.
Right, right. Well, it's that Aramaic rule of Rachma that you know, Paul talks about we see as though through a glass darkly, and when hostility or fear is active in the mind, whoever we look at, you know, if the mind is in fear, it's like that schematic I sent you last week, the mind is in fear, anything or anybody that it looks at, the mind will literally produce a quality of perception called threat. They're going to be threatened by it. If hostility is the active filter in the mind, then the mind's going to produce a reality that shows something irritating. If love is active, then when that's the active filter, then the mind is going to produce evidence based in love. And it just changes everything. And it's, you know, it's such a brilliant, when you realize it, ingenious piece of instruction. Oh, you keep love present in your mind. It's not about loving your neighbor. That's the Greek sophist's interpretation. Let's take away the substance, and we'll tell people to go love their neighbors. Well, let me see. I'm going to try to love the neighbor that just came in and, you know, whacked away at me and did their best to destroy something of mine. And, of course, if I have hostility in me about that, then hostility is going to come. I'm going to feel like a total failure trying to love my neighbor when they've resonated my rage. And it's a setup when we understand what was really meant. Oh, the efforting is to keep your human beingness present and active in your mind, love, no matter what your neighbor does. That's the most intelligent mind we could possibly have. And, you know, it just works. It improves lives immeasurably.
Well, thank you for that. And I just realized that this thing about neighbor, hearing what has been said, I can feel myself, my own inner, kind of worldview changing a little bit about that, because I would be disappointed that my next door neighbors, or not, you know, next door, whatever, wouldn't even connect no matter what. And at the same time, there would be people I would think about on a regular basis that love to connect. And I don't know, all that's been a bit enriched in me that I can, oh yeah, what is a neighbor? And it is based in love, is it not?
Yeah, it's just a monumental piece of information they have to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Any other thoughts for you, sir?
Well, just that. I mean, I've been enriched from that one, and I appreciate it. I appreciate Eugene and all that. And, no, I think I'm good for now, and I appreciate your time.
Well, I hope that every day we connect that we enrich your life. That's what we're here for. Sweet.
Okay.
I appreciate you, my friend. Have a blessed one.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, and we have another caller.
Well, Miss Jeannie. Oh, great. Let's say hello.
Okay.
It's so nice not to have to ask.
I know. 541, I think this is Julie in Oregon. You're on the air.
Miss Julie in Ashland, Oregon. Are you back in Ashland now? Did I understand that's your landing place most recently?
I'm not coming through.
Oh, you're loud and clear.
We can hear you. Oh, I am. Okay. Good.
Yeah.
Hi. Okay.
Hey.
Yes, I'm in Ashland. Julie from Ashland.
I knew
Oregon.
You'd moved out of there, and then I wasn't sure whether you'd gone back there or the last move, but that's what I understood. So, well, welcome, Julie, from Ashland, Oregon. What's exciting in your world?
Well, I do have something to share, but I also last night was remembering the teacher's training that I was in and that really, really funny skit that I did with Bill Costantino. And I've always
Hilarious.
I know, it really was. Everybody was laughing so much. So I have a recording of that. I believe he does too. And I'm not sure how to get it to you, but I just thought you might like to have it, you know, in your archive.
Oh, I would. I would.
That would be awesome.
Yeah,
that
Jeannie,
would be awesome.
No, it's just so funny. If you could listen, Jeannie, if you would guide me through how to get it to you, because it's, you know, you can call me another time, but it's on one of my older phones, so I'm not wired up.
Okay.
Okay? But I could be.
Okay, we'll do it. Okay.
Okay. Okay, great. So here's the thing, a very brief and profound thing that I'm going to share right now, is that I've had a wonderful mind shifter that I haven't worked on, but I've been noticing my resistance to it. And anyway, I have this back and forth resistance in my relationship with my partner. And so we were fighting about the same things, and I'd really finally evolved myself to the point of I was ready to let it go and let the whole relationship go. But then I also was telling God, well, I really love him and I really want him in my life. So, you know, there's that. But what happened is that it occurred to me that his pain was calling out for love, you know, from the Course of Miracles. And and also recently I'd read somewhere in all these studies that love is not something that can be taught, you know. And so I'm holding that consciousness of, well, I guess it just has to have to find out or create it or be with it. And today you use the presence, hold the presence of love, the truth of it, and let it be.
Yes.
And so, but what I did last night is I recognized that, you know, he was calling out and arguing from a place of pain that I was trying to fix. And I knew all those answers, but he didn't, I concluded that he didn't really want to heal. And so, anyway, I'm at home thinking, and it hits me, he's just calling for love. Can I give love? So I did. I called and said, I'm going to come back over if you'd like me to, and just I want to be held in your arms. Because I also realized I was calling for love, right? I didn't want the argument.
Right.
And so that's what we did, and we resolved everything with love. Not every bit of the argument, but the argument wasn't important. What was important was what can't be taught, the love that we experience.
Yeah.
So that was
just the love that we are. Nice choice.
Mm-hmm. And I'm looking forward to this weekend, Shifters.
Cool.
I have a beeper going because there's a spam call coming in.
Okay, no problem.
So, and I appreciate
the chapter.
So
thanks for choosing love.
What?
Thanks for choosing love.
Yeah, yesterday you were in the chapter, and today, and for a few days now, clarifying love. And I thought, well, that's really an interesting way of holding the space of love, is to keep it clear. Like, let's clarify how we're viewing love rather than just coming from our perceptions, our perceptual reality, and get clear on it and be willing to be clear on it. And the only way I knew yesterday was to allow it to be what it is and show me. And let it be created, you know, let it be. So, well, anyway, it was very nice, and I appreciate our work. And looking forward to Saturday.
Sweet. Well, you know, it's just, it's so important to really recognize, like, you know, so we have a conflict in opinion, and we can make that important. And, you know, people spend years doing that, or we stop and go, well, we haven't got this resolved. We may never resolve it. But what's really true about us is that we can be the space of love that we are and share that, extend that to each other. So, like,
yeah, and it doesn't have to be a threat to anything else, you know. It
exactly.
It just supersedes, and it's more preferred. It, you know, it doesn't have to be at that ego level. Yeah.
Right. Nice.
Mm-hmm.
Good work,
well,
young lady.
Thank you very much. Yes, and I do want to send that recording to you, because, I mean, everybody was laughing. It was like the kind of laughter that you hear on a Carol Burnett show.
It was. It was hilarious. And, you know, so that people who don't know what you're talking about, you know, when we do teacher training for Why Is This Happening to Me Again, the class together produces a Why Is This Happening to Me Again workshop. And so we have people, you know, there's a variety of people in the class, and everybody presents differently. So we've had people who've gotten up and done a lesson, their particular part in the production of a Why Is This Happening to Me Again workshop, and sung their part. We've had people, like, you know, what she's talking about, they just came up with this skit to illustrate the point of one of the chapters in the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? That was just so hilarious. It was just unbelievable. I remember one, I don't know whether it was that year, Julie, that there was one, there were two women, and we were just finishing up lunch, and they were up to do their teaching in the class, and you know, everybody's just getting ready. Was this that year? And one of them yells at the other one, and the other one yells back, and they, all of a sudden there's just this big conflict at the front of the room, and everybody's like, "Whoa, what's going on here?" And it took everybody a few minutes to realize that they started their presentation, and this was part of their presentation to get everybody's attention to thinking that there was some big conflict going on here. And I don't remember what chapter in the book it was, but it was another powerful lesson, like the one that you and Bill did back then. Yeah, it was awesome.
I wasn't there for that one, but I can understand it. I get that exactly. Yeah.
Cool. I'll look forward to getting to listen to it again.
Yeah. Yeah. You're going to call Bill?
You know, I talked to Bill about maybe 5 or 6 months ago. He sounds like he's doing pretty well.
You know, he is very technically oriented, too. So
yes.
So further along than me. He probably could send you the MP3 or whatever in an instant. You know.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Oh, maybe I'll drop him
a
note.
Yeah.
All right.
We'll get it one.
Well, we'll let you guys check it out first. And
yeah.
All right, we're down to the last few seconds, so I'm going to just say thank you, everybody, for your participation, and create the best year yet of your eternal life. It's an awesome gift to give. Blessings. Bye-bye.
Evolving continuously.
Thank you for listening to Mind Shifters Radio with Dr. Michael Rice and myself, Jeannie Rice, and Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet, as we present the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We are here for 2 hours every Monday through Friday from 12 noon to 2 o'clock Eastern Time on Mind Shifters Radio. For more information on Aramaic forgiveness, please visit www.whyagain.org. That's www.whyagain.org.